am I reading this right? Hofstra guy as well. My sister coached field hockey at Hofstra, so much love.
Double Hofstra. I think they named a wing after my parents. Seven straight years.
Now, did you go to Islanders games as a student supposed to be studying at the time? Periodically.
I grew up in East Meadow, Long Island, 5 minutes away from the Nassau Coliseum, and I was ostracized throughout high school as being the only New York Rangers fan. And I caught tremendous abuse throughout high school. In fact, when the Islanders clinched their first Stanley Cup in 1980, rather than celebrate, it just seemed like the entirety of my high school drove by my house to razz me. So I have a little bit of a complex.
You were a lonely, lonely Ron Duguay fan at that point in time. John Davidson fan at that point in time.
Lucien Deblois.
So tell us about your reaction to this settlement. Steve Moore was asking for over $50 million. Would this have been a complex case? And sometimes we see a litigant settle simply because the pain of going to trial, and obviously it's been a very difficult a decade plus for him dealing with, because he's had to deal with this so publicly, whereas many litigants do not have to deal with something in, you're so in the camera eye if you've been Steve Moore the last 12 years.
Well, unfortunately, not a lot of attention has been placed on Steve Moore's story, because the strategy of the Canucks and the strategy of Todd Bertuzzi's legal team has been delay. It's been 10 years and he has yet to receive his day in court. Let's understand one thing. Mr. Bertuzzi pled guilty to a criminal assault. This was going to be a very straightforward trial as to liability against Mr. Bertuzzi. The question is, how much do you value the lost earnings and lost wage opportunities of Mr. Moore? And I believe this was a significant settlement.
Why has it taken so long, over 10 years? Why are we 10 years later and just now getting a resolution to this?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert on the Canadian justice system, but the case was originally filed in the United States, I believe in a Colorado court. There were some legal wranglings over the proper venue of the case. And to be quite honest, I don't know why we're still here 10 years later. They say that our justice system moves pretty quickly or pretty slowly. 10 years is outrageous. And on the eve of trial, I would speculate that if a settlement has in fact been reached, it was one that was very advantageous to Mr. Moore. I would even go so far as to say that this was an eight-figure settlement. We're not going to find out the numbers for a while, if ever. But I think we're looking at $10 to $20 million with the potential of the NHL kicking in some of the money to avoid the embarrassment of having its entire culture placed on trial.
Daniel Wallach, our guest on Brady and Walker. I'm Greg Brady. He's Ben Ennis. I would also wonder, does this set any kind of legal precedent? Or as you noted in your first answer, you would need a criminal charge and a criminal plea of guilty to get it to this point. We see things, you see things, Dan. You could sit in your basement, we could sit in ours and see all the time and see something that I guess goes above and beyond the game itself, and say, I wonder if someone would take legal action given a career was ended by a hit or a cheap shot. Could this set any precedent?
No, it was an out of court. If in fact a settlement was reached, and that's still a matter of debate, nothing has changed in the NHL. I mean, wouldn't you think as a result of this injury, the NHL would have instituted major reforms? But as we go through game by game, year by year, we see similar incidents taking place. The premeditated assault on Rick DiPietro of the Islanders about 5 or 6 years ago, which as a practical matter did end his career. The shenanigans of Matt Cook. Mm-hmm. It just seems as if the revenge culture in the NHL is alive and well. And this case, this lawsuit, will have changed nothing. The only possibility of major changes being instituted would have been a public outcry as a result of what we would learn during the trial. And now that's gone.
Yeah, and I wonder how much we'll ever hear about this, because I imagine as part of this settlement there will be some sort of non-disclosure agreement. Do you agree with that, that Steve Moore will probably, as part of taking whatever money he will be given, probably can't talk about this anymore?
That's probably a fair statement, because look, there's nothing that he would have to, there's nothing to disclose really, except the cash value of the settlement. There's not going to be any admission of liability by Moore. It's a standard settlement clause. You know, by entering into the settlement, we don't admit or deny wrongdoing, blah, blah, blah. So, the issue of disparagement really doesn't come into play. Because he's not privy to any kind of secret information. Nothing came out during the trial. So I don't believe a disparagement provision is really going to be the cornerstone of this settlement agreement, although it's probably he's probably barred from talking about the amount.
I wonder as well, the only thing I could see that would parallel this, you'd almost need and I think we're past the kind where we have these beanball incidents when we were a lot younger, Daniel, in baseball and you get managers kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah, it's part of the game. It's part of the code. But you'd need a career-ending beanball for a lawyer to step up and say, I'm stepping in here. This went above and beyond what's in the sport itself. That's my perspective on it.
Well, beanballs are a little bit more within the range of risk because it's difficult. How do you make the determination that a beanball was the result of specific intent to end somebody's career? There's a fine line. But what happened here went far, far beyond that. This was a premeditated, pre-planned, vicious assault from behind, which had been in the works and had been threatened for months. Beanballs usually, except in very rare cases, usually occur in the flow of one particular game, and it's such a fine line. It's hard to say for sure whether the pitcher had intent to harm. Did he have intent to send a message, or did he just have intent?
You're right.
The guy's career.
But isn't that what we can never prove about Bertuzzi? You're right. It's vicious. It's premeditated. The Canucks all talked about it. We don't know what was on the chalkboard and et cetera. There's a lot of people that should be held maybe even more accountable accountable as Todd Bertuzzi for this. That said, can Bertuzzi make the case? It's almost a devil's advocate principle that if five other guys don't jump me, there isn't the injury. Like, I had a lot of people calling me on my show the morning after it happened saying he meant to, and I'm like, how would we ever prove that he meant to break a man's neck? How would we delineate between, it's like a car accident. How would we ever prove that someone meant to cause such vehicular damage?
Because, Greg, now we know years after the fact, Mr. Bertuzzi said in a court filing that his coach ordered him to do it.
But not necessarily that extent of the injury. You're right. He was ordered to attack. That's his argument. Yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah, he was ordered to attack, and he's responsible for all the injuries which result from from his intentional act. You take your there's a saying in the law: you take your plaintiff as you find him. Mm-hmm. So the intent to attack makes the attacker responsible for the ensuing injuries.
Yeah, totally understandable. He's at Wallach Legal. Daniel Wallach joining us on Brady and Walker. Thanks so much for doing this. Really enjoyed chatting with you, Daniel, and hope we can do it again.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me on the air, Greg, and have a great day. And, just good luck this year in Toronto.